It's too narrow. You would need a duplexer for that. One of those cavity duplexers.
Oh, look at the duplexers. They're very large in size, and they have these containers filled with some liquid, and supposedly they can separate a 600 kilohertz transmit and receive.
Yes, that's what I just said. I said if you want to operate that close together, you need a duplexer, which is a cavity filter device that has a very high Q. It has a high cutoff. If you are doing two different bands, like one is UHF and the other is VHF, a diplexer, again, is incredibly cheaper. Duplexers are thousands of dollars. Diplexers are $100 and change. But if you try to diplexer, again, it doesn't have a high enough Q to shield the other side. 600 kilohertz is not different enough that a medium to low Q filter will be able to block that signal. That's why you would need something with a very high Q, like a duplexer.
What happens if you have a UHF signal, 440, and you want to transmit on 440, you want to receive on 445? What are the qualifications for the duplexer?
It's kind of a slippery slide. My guess would be a 4 megahertz difference is not going to work for a diplexer. Diplexers don't have the high enough Q to accomplish it. You would have to kind of operate on two different bands to allow the use of a low Q diplexer. Otherwise, I don't exactly know what the standard split on 440 is, but it's not that much different. So that requires another duplexer. So you're still talking about a frequency difference that requires a very high Q, expensive device, like a duplexer instead of a diplexer.
Well, let's say you're going camping. You have a retifist repeater. You could set the transmit frequency and the receive frequency all the way down to 5 megahertz. But, it's not guaranteed, What do you know about this?
I'm not quite sure what you're alluding to.
It's one of these, one of these repeaters. They say it's a repeater, and you use it for camping or hiking, so that so much signal will not reach any normal civilization. So the idea is you have transmitter and receiver in the box.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, ultimately, it's a function of what is the power output. If you're only going to be using it within, a couple of meters, then you don't have to quite worry because it's so low signal that a reasonable medium to low Q diplexer might be enough to offer you an attenuation of the signal such that it won't burn out the front end. You're kind of gambling with it. But, ultimately, if you have the output power low enough, the amount that's going to get through a low Q diplexer might not be sufficient to damage your radio. That's the best I can answer because I'm not quite sure what the question is.
Well, as far as I know, these repeaters, mini repeaters, that have up to 10 watts, and I guess you would use them at 5 watts, and as low as 5 megahertz split.
Well, ultimately it depends upon the sensitivity of the receiver to the transmitted signal. If it's all made together, everything included, then one would hope that the engineers would limit the sensitivity of the front end and make it somewhat more bulletproof for burning out the front end.
I guess they make them so that, you think that if you buy this thing, you'll be able to extend your range.
Yeah, okay, but again, it's a matter of engineering. It's a matter of odds. If you, if you air too much, if you allow your filter to return too much signal to your front end of your receiver, inevitably you're going to burn it out. So, if it's well engineered and has a bunch of safety features that kind of has attenuation locks, if it senses input currents too high, then I guess you can do it, but it has to be specifically designed for that operation.
Well, I think for the most part, it's two walkie-talkies inside of a box, receive and transmit. I don't know what other hardware is in there.
It's easy to build.
Yeah, Jeff?
Yeah, I have just such a repeater. I bought it a while ago for testing, and it is much more than just two walkie-talkies in a box. It is a box, and it has a couple radios, and it has has a receiver and a transmitter. It has a controller that is programmable from a screen with buttons that's viewable through the case, and it has a little six-cavity diplexer in it. Duplexer in it that you can set to the standard split for UHF. It's a decent device for the money. It's not a high-end repeater. It's just a quick portable setup. You put it up somewhere high if you're hunting in the mountains, and then everyone can hit it, I guess.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Then it has a built-in duplexer that's designed for its power handling capability.
Roger. I think I got, 5 to 10 watts out of it, and I put it on top of my work building and tested it with some friends in the Bronx.
Okay, very good. So, you hear that, David? It has its own duplexer.
QSL. I was looking at that. I was very interested in it, but so far I didn't buy one.
What price do those things go for usually, Jeff?
ACTPL. I seem to recall, this was a few years back that I bought it, but I seem to recall it was maybe $500, something like that. The problem, David, when you put one of these up is if you're in a populated area, you have to worry about coordination. And if you're going to run an uncoordinated repeater, you run the risk of interference, number one. Number two, if you're going to move to a frequency where you're not interfering, you have to tune the duplexer. And you have to tune the duplexer, and actually, Roy will tell you more about this, but to tune the duplexer, you need a little bit more sophisticated gear than the typical ham will have. It's something where you're actually measuring, using a tracking generator, and measuring input and output power, and monitoring it as a function of frequency, QSL. Myself, sir.
Okie doke. Thank you, Jeff. Tuning up those duplexers is an art for, it seems, if you've ever watched someone do it and you need the proper equipment. Any other comments on this subject? Feel free, hit that push to talk.
Comments on RF ground?
Yes, you're rather noisy. I could only make out about a third of what you said. If you can wiggle the whip antenna or raise some gain or put the antenna near a window or somehow hit the repeater a little more strongly, I'd appreciate it. Sorry, it's still noise. We do have an Echo Link, and we have All-Star as well. There are different ways of connecting to the repeater if you just can't do it via RF.
Okay, I think I'm in a good spot from what I remember last time. 82MAR, can you hear me now?
Yes, that's a lot better. There's still a bit of noise, but a lot better.
What I was wondering, is it possible, instead of using a braided tin copper wire for grounding your radio to, let's say, for example, grounding right into the ground, can you use for center conductor of a coax cable, specifically LMR600 coax? And if it's a long run, the shield will protect the center grounded conductor from becoming resonating like an antenna would. Would the shield prevent that from happening? This is KB2MAR.
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'd have to look at the electrodynamics of it, but the problem with using a center wire as the grounding conductor is that the impedance should be relatively high. As you kind of take a piece of metal and flatten it thinner and thinner, wider and wider, its impedance, its inductance drops, and with it, its impedance. I don't think a ground shield surrounding the wire itself is going to change its inductance. So I don't think it would particularly help. And the reason why I generally recommend a flat piece of copper strapping as opposed to the shielding of a coax cable for external use is because having those multiple pieces of wire intertwined is great as long as it's not corroded. Out in the open air and the rain and such, the copper is going to corrode, and each of those particular corrosion points will act as nonlinear diodes and produce all kinds of harmonic signals on the local RF in your area. The same reason why it's never a good idea to use a screen wire as your radials. Instead of single radial wires coming out at the center, some people think they're going to be clever and they just drop a layer of mesh all over the ground, which is great for the first week or two, but as the mesh starts to corrode, it has other problems it introduces.
This RF interference thing is really challenging. It's actually more challenging than making antennas and designing them and all that kind of stuff. It's really something unbelievable. Every little detail could be perfect. So a lot of variables there.
Easy to go.
Yes, Jeff?
One comment for MAR. Old friend, by the way. If you've got LMR600 lying around, it's kind of an expensive venture, but for all the reasons Roy just mentioned, you could use the shield on that as the grounding cable as opposed to the center conductor. The shield, in that case, would be braided, it would be tinned, it would be easy to connect, and it would be protected from the environment.
Yeah, I agree with you. Kind of an expensive thing to do. Although copper strapping is not cheap either.
So I think either shield or the it's easy to run
that kind of stuff. Yeah, the reason why I chose to use the shielded portion, I'm sorry, the semiconductor of a shielded coax, is because let's say you have a long run. You know how when you have a long run of a braided copper line that's too long and it would begin to resonate to RF frequencies that you don't want to resonate on, you have to cut it a certain length. That's what else I was getting at.
Well, I don't know if there's that much of a chance of, you know, I mean, you'd need to have common mode currents operating to begin with, and then it'd just be a kind of extra layer of confusion and complication. The best way to address that in all conditions is to provide enough RF choking to not have common mode currents inducing currents in any particular run of wire that you're that you want to use for something that isn't a transmission line.
The QSL. Yeah, I guess I have my work cut out for me here. So it's a little challenging. I know it sounds so simple, but there are variables you got to take into consideration there. But by the way, we also have a field day operation in late January, and we have trouble with a power pole that the mast put an antenna on, which I think is not the right way to do it, because you have the GPL hitching a ride on the outer shield of the coax. You got to use ferrite beads to help block that signal going into the shack. But that's going to be another challenge in itself.
Yeah. I mean, things are simple when people have simple ideas about things. And unfortunately, I've described the science in general is like an onion. When you peel the onion, you still have another layer of the onion. And you can keep on doing that. And for the sake of theoretical constructs, you know, science is kind of like an infinite onion. So the more you plumb the depths, the more confusing it will get. You know, I mean, I've watched more than a few PBS type of shows where the question at the beginning of the show is, what is time? And after an hour of watching it, you have no idea what time possibly could be. So you could do that with almost any subject. You know, what is gravity? What is light? What is this? What is that? So it's just how long you want to kind of shovel your way in down the rabbit hole of how complicated almost everything inevitably gets.
Okay, Roy, thanks for the input there. Everyone else, thank you so much. And we'll send over to you, Roy, or I'll be listening on the side. This is KB7AR, back to Net Control.
Okay, Doc, this is AC2GS with Limark Technical Net. We're still open for business. If anyone has any further things to say of this on the subject, feel free. If not, we'll ask if anyone has any new topics for discussion. Okay, any other new topics for discussion out there, feel free. Hit that push to talk. Yes, David?
I had an experience with audio intelligibility versus fidelity.
Okay. Fidelity should be the accurate reproduction of a sound in comparison to its the original source of that signal. Readability it could be a lot less than fidelity. It simply means that the information embedded in the audio is able to be extracted by a person listening to it.
Well, in ham radio, signal is mostly mid-range. So a lot of the fidelity is removed, and maybe fidelity isn't as necessary as intelligibility?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it depends on the person involved in the situation. You talk to an average AM guy, and he'll tell you endlessly about the beautiful sound quality of his AM signal versus the junk that he hears on a single sideband conversation. But if you're only interested in getting across, if you're looking for wallpaper and you're getting across a signal, you know, strength and a caller and a call sign ID and other such things, it's much more important that you get the information, even if it sounds terrible. You know, if it makes your ears bleed, if it gets you more pickups. A lot of times, contestants will knowingly adjust the audio quality of their transmissions. They'll use compressors and all kinds of gadgets to make the audio far less enjoyable, but it will be heard. And for a contest, it's more important to be heard readability than to have a beautiful lilting quality in your audio.
QSL. I mean, I think for single sideband radios, it's good to have the ability to adjust the audio that you receive and also the audio that you transmit to a certain degree.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, the different modes have different qualities of their audio. Frequency modulation has full quieting, so it has a lot less background noise that can annoy some people, depending upon whether it's a wide band or a narrow band. It has more fidelity because it's able to capture and reproduce a wider bandwidth. But with single sideband, it's usually people use about, you know, 2.7, 2.8 kilohertz bandwidth. It allows for the intelligent exchange of information, but does not reproduce your voice the way a guy listening to you talk in the same room, listening in the same room hears the way that you talk. But again, it depends upon the point of your transmission. If it's much more important for you to play a bit of music and have it reproduced flawlessly, you have to keep other things in mind than if you just want to tell someone a bit of information that requires a much narrower bandwidth.
KFQCZ?
Yeah?
Happy holidays. This is Brian. Beyond the side, still requested.
Okay, very good, Brian. Merry Christmas. I kind of introed the Merry Christmas at the very top of the net. I'm sure I will mention it on my way out as well. So you just sit there and listen, and when something comes to mind, feel free. Let me ask you a kind of a question of the night. You were always asking about what the topic is. We usually don't have topics. Sam earlier, AE2YG, was looking for a professional electrical engineer capable of looking at his shack system and recommending grounding principles, bonding and what should be grounded and how it should be grounded and such. You have any ideas of how you find a guy like that?
I would go log into QRC and look on their forums and maybe put in a request.
Okay, that's reasonable. The guy earlier suggested contact the ARRL, and perhaps they had some names in the area in a Rolodex. But that's a good one, too.
ARRL is a fine source as well.
Yep. I promised Sam that I'd ask it at least one time. Hopefully I'll have time to do it one more time, you know, as people check in, just to see if someone has another idea.
What does he want to do exactly?
He wants to have his shack up to specs. He wants to be as grounded as he can be.
Well, what kind of rig is he running? Why does he need to be... I mean, if he's grounded properly, that should be the end of it, no?
Well, you know, I mean, you could always ground something more. You know, if you have two ground rods that are bonded together, theoretically, you could get four ground rods that are bonded together. But, you know, I mean, he has a standard operating system. He has an antenna, I think, on the top of his brownstone. So it's about 30-plus feet off of the ground, and not a lot of options as far as ground rods are concerned.
Perhaps a storm gutter that goes into the ground, metal storm gutter, or called a water pipe, maybe?
Well, I mean, these are all interesting, useful options. They're still compromises. I think he wants a belt and suspenders industrial strength solution to grounding his antenna system and his shack and such. So, you know, he's looking for a professional.
I think that an electrician should be able to do this.
See, ordinarily I would sort of agree with you, but electricians come in different flavors, unfortunately. I've experienced far too many who kind of vary. You know, you find a electrician, especially associated with a local utility a system where they have to, by law, know their stuff about grounding everything. And, you know, if he wants to make some a business, you know, consulting on the weekend. So I'm sure there are, because, you know, I mean, the electrical code is probably much better known by electricians than electrical engineers. But I think the problem is finding the right electrician. You know, some electricians have not really absorbed a lot of things that they should have through their professional life. So you'd have to kind of filter it somehow. You couldn't just kind of generally hire an electrician to do it for you and assume that you were going to get the best possible, you know, consultation.
KD2FIU?
Yes, George.
Electricians are very knowledgeable, but they really can't help you with this. There are questions to ask. Is it a building? A multiple dwelling building? Is it composite structure? Is it brick? Is the building aluminum sided single family home? Is it detached? Are the power wires overline or overground, underground? There's so many questions to ask. Then you determine, without precision, how to eliminate all of the structural factors that are going to give you defective grounding systems. You don't go and say that I'm going to assemble a very effective grounding system. You want to eliminate the possibilities of defective grounding systems with the entire structure that you live in first. Do you have a central high conductive water pipe systems in the house? And I don't mean water delivery. I don't mean gas pipe delivery. I mean water pipe air vent systems in the house. Is it a house? Is it a building? All of these questions have to be asked to say, how do I ground my radio? Am I grounding for static and receive? Am I grounding on a private property for lightning arrest? Do I have the ability to throw a rod 8, 10, 12 feet away from the house to eliminate what I have? This is all on observation. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. Again, Sam just wants some good suggestions of how to find a professional who will come to his house, which is a brownstone, and suss out the place and figure it out and give him his recommendations. That was the question that opened up the net tonight.
Roy, did I offer anything here?
Well, yeah, I mean, you pointed out obvious aspects of electrical systems. Sam still wants a guy to come by and take a look-see and give him a report. He wants a consultation.
Roy, Alpha 2, Yankee Golf.
Yes, Sam.
First of all, thank you very much for bringing up the topic on my behalf. And quite frankly, the gentleman who mentioned electrician, it was a eureka moment. I happen to represent some electrical contractors. It just came together, and I will reach out to them and see if one of them can pull this off for me. But the thought hit me when the person mentioned electricians. Then it hit me what to do. And I want to thank you all very much for all your input. I think I just solved the problem. Thank you, Roy.
KD2FYU.
You're welcome, Sam. Yes, George?
Roy, I would like to address Sam.
Feel free.
Sam, they may not be knowledgeable on HF interference.
Agreed. What you have to say is all very valid. And I have a couple of ideas from this conversation this evening. George, it's good to hear you again. And Roy, I'll still be listening. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thanks, everyone, for participating. If anyone has any other comments on this once again, before we close it and move back to what we were talking about earlier, feel free to hit that push to talk.
And one windy line comment.
73, Roy, KD2FIU.
73, George. Yes, Hank?
I might suggest that he look up a land mobile installer. They're found in the Yellow Pages, at least they used to be when there were Yellow Pages. And while they might not be ideal for HF, they would certainly know their limitations since they normally deal with VHF and UHF.
Okay, that's a good suggestion. I'm sure Sam is still listening, so I thank you for that one, Hank.
Wrote it down.
Okay, very good.
Comment?
Sure.
Well, Sam, this is Brian, KF2ZZ, and I have been a part of many installations for telecommunications over the years. And there's a couple of things that you could do. If you want an electrician, you want someone that does commercial electrical only. If for an electrician, you want a company that is extremely reputable, that has a tremendous amount of knowledge, and you want someone that is on commercial, not residential. The commercial, they tend to know a lot more, I find, than the residential. The second part is that you can call up the ARRL, and you can go ahead and speak with them. Some people over there about, you know, how to ground properly. They even have some books on grounding and bonding, which are pretty well written. And the other thing is that you could go ahead and seek out a broadcast engineer, like in radio or television broadcasting. There are companies that specialize in communications, and any of these companies that erect towers or put up antennas for, you know, major, you know, radio and television networks would probably be a very, very good idea to go ahead and do the research on that. So broadcast engineering as well. So with those three things, I just want to go ahead and mention that to you, and I'll be on the side.
Okie doke, very good. AC2GS, I guess we'll move on. There is a new topic. Again, the night is still relatively young, so if anyone has any questions or comments or topics that they'd like to roll around, please hit that push to talk and ID yourselves.
Brian, KF2ZZ, with a quick follow-up.
Okay, Brian.
Sam, where do you, what is your QTH? Sam, leave
Sam, do you, I don't know. Sam, are you out there? Brian is asking you a question about your location.
I'm in Park Slope.
Okay. Well, that makes it pretty easy then. There are a number of radio stations, of course, in the New York City area that you could call and also speak with their engineering department. You could see if they know anybody because they're basically broadcast people. And they may be able to advise you. That's just another way in to go ahead and extract information. KF2CC on the side.
Thank you very
okay.
much for the idea.
Okay, that certainly is an interesting idea. I don't know. And radio stations are. I get the sense that a lot of them are practically on autopilot these days, just running pre-recorded slop. Okay, once again, this is AC2GS with the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any questions, comments, or topics of a conversation about technology, science, or what the, who knows, maybe even amateur radio, please ID yourself.
KF2ZZ.
Yeah, Brian?
For the past three nights, I've been noticing that on 40 meters, the noise level has been almost like a signal strength meter reading about a 9. And I'm just curious why at night that would happen.
It could be a phenomenon of local radio noise background. Usually, the noise floor goes up during when the sun is out because the D layer gets over-energized, and you know there is such a thing as too much of a good thing. When you ionize the D layer of the ionosphere too strongly, it produces a lot of random noise that obscures the underlying transmission signals. So I'm not exactly sure in your case why you're noticing an increase in the noise floor in the middle of the night when the delayer should be the quietest is going to be over, you know, 24 hours.
Interestingly enough, on not only 40 meters, but also on 20 meters, the same exact thing. Very high noise level. Come the morning, very quiet.
Again, not quite sure. Yes, Jeff.
I called in a couple weeks ago about people with all the lights up, the holiday lights that go on when it gets dark, stay on, some of them, until the sun comes up. And I spent one evening chasing down the noise source in my the noise sources in my neighborhood. And boy, did I find noise sources all over the place. My God, it was unbelievable. And I did a lot of my driving around in the unreasonable hours, like 1, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. And I found the major noise source for me was only a block and a half away. I told you guys before about meeting this gentleman who called me all kinds of names when I asked him if we could do some experiments of him turning off some of his strings of lights. His house was lit up like a Times Square sign. But if you drive around your neighborhood, you put your broadcast radio on at night and try to find a spot on the AM dial where there's no local station, just drive down blocks around you, and you'd be surprised how many noise sources you're going to find with these Christmas ornament lights. And there's nothing I can do until the season is over. Some of that noise sources could be man-made. It might not be us, from the atmosphere. But 40 meters, I do a lot of operations on 40 meters, and you never know what the noise floor is going to be. It could go anywhere at my house during the day and into the afternoon, but mostly in the mornings, in the daytime, from S2 to S8. And different days, different noise floors. So it's a common characteristic of 40 meters to pick up noise.
Yeah, it certainly is, and that's a good suggestion, Chet. As I mentioned earlier, that it's probably a local phenomenon. There's some multiple sources of RF interference locally that's provoking it. Again, because usually solar aspects don't quiet down during the daytime. They get noisier during the daytime. So there's probably some source a couple of blocks away from you that would explain the phenomena.
Well, there's nothing like a little pair of wire cutters and doing it once at a time.
Well, I will urge
WP2HK. Cameras are everywhere. You can't do anything anymore without being recorded. You don't have no idea how you think that you could go in the middle of the night and go someplace and do some snipping. But somebody's going to record you, and your license plate of your car, you just can't escape cameras anymore.
Oh, obviously,
yes, I agree.
I'm just joking, you know.
Unless you can get Harry Potter's invisibility cloak, then you have a chance. Yeah, I guess there's no Harry Potter fans out there.
I don't know, I'd rather have a Klingon bird of prey with its cloak.
Well, if you can get it into space, but I mean, where are you going to park it on the sidewalk?
Oh, boy. I don't know. My sidewalk certainly isn't big enough. N1Y, do I?
Yeah, you got to think about that. I mean, it's not like it's the Jetsons, although that would be cool, too. I'm sure most of us out there remember that cartoon where he kind of comes home and his spaceship collapses into a briefcase.
WB2HK just came up with an idea.
This has already been had.
Yeah, we have two people, Chet first and Hank second.
I just came up with a great idea. I'm not going to do it, but get yourself a good drone to steer it remotely with wire clippers on the coming down on the bottom of it. Rig it up somehow that it can fly someplace and do some clipping here and there. I'm pretty sure even with cameras, they're not going to follow the drone. Go ahead.
Well, it's a good thing to theorize. I think it would be highly impractical for a drone to be able to cut simple wires, you know, while hovering. You know, I mean, usually, unfortunately, if you follow the way drones sort of work, they just kind of buzz above an object that people like the Ukrainians want to destroy, and then they just drop grenades on top of them. And, you know, it's more of a... a hammer rather than a scalpel.
It's nice to think about it, though. That'll be about the only thing that you can get away with that kind of crime.
I guess, but you know, I knew people who used to threaten repeatedly that if a drone got anywhere near their property, they would shotgun it to death. You know, although they're inexpensive, they're not quite that inexpensive. And I'm sure the police wouldn't be happy with people, you know, shooting shotguns into the air. Okay, Hank, what did you want to say?
Well, I wanted to say that my original idea has already been superseded, so I guess I'm done. But if on the idea of the clippers, why not just use head shears, and then the mere threat of the thing would scare the owner of the house?
I guess so, but again, that's a rather high-mass object. It requires stronger motors And you know, it's probably given to not be as fine maneuvering aerodynamically and such. You might be better off something as relatively simple as a laser. You know, they make rather strong UV lasers that cut everything these days. So perhaps a laser would be a finer instrument than a pair of wire snippers.
Well, if we're fantasizing about lasers, I suggest we go for an X-ray laser. And with that, I really am clear. And one YD1.
Okay. You know, I mean, the most powerful that I see in commercial with, you know, individuals with buying them and using them are UV. You know, I don't think companies are selling X-ray lasers to non-coms and such. But they do amazing things. If you've ever seen a YouTube of people promoting UV lasers, you're able to do designs embedded in glass and other transparent mediums because it doesn't burn anything. It just breaks it. So UV lasers, very interesting devices. Of course, commercially, you could get everything from a carbon dioxide infrared laser all the way to a UV laser. So, you know, it's interesting to see how that market develops and how many people are going to get themselves blind because they refuse to use proper safety gear. And the safety interlocks on some of these things are not really up to snuff.
Well, I do do certainly agree that the safety interlocks probably aren't up to stuff. It's been a long time since I worked for Grumman, but it was a lot of fun to talk to the engineers back then about what was on the horizon. And I guess I probably should watch more YouTube to know what's actually here.
Yeah, we pretty much live in the golden age of technology. If you sleep too late, you'll miss a discovery. I regularly am told about things that I never got around to reading about just in amateur radio here on the technical net. But, I mean, there are thousands and thousands of research and development companies that are cranking new patents out and all kinds of interesting use for slightly older technology. It's a great time if you're into technology. Terrible time for a bunch of other things, but it's a great time for technology. And, you know, as part of our technical net, this is a little node where we can discuss new and developing technology. There was some talk about companies merging together, one that is doing research on fusion technology. And unfortunately, if you've been paying attention to when I mentioned what's going on with fusion, a lot of the reports are misinterpreted and kind of hyperbole to death. So far, they've been using lasers to generate small amounts of fusion energy that up until recently didn't even equal the amount of energy put into the absolute power of the laser. But that has been a breakthrough. Unfortunately, that is not the amount of power you have to apply to the laser. The lasers are very inefficient. So if you factor in actually how much energy you had to apply to the laser that caused the fusion reaction, it's much more energy than anyone has gotten out even yet. So unfortunately, like it's been for 50, 60 years, fusion technology is probably only 20 years in our future and will be 20 years in our future for the foreseeable future. Anyway, that's my little 2 cents worth. Because every so often I like to blow little holes on hyperbole in technology. People mean well. They're excited with technology. I'm excited with technology as well. But sometimes if you misstate things and promote things excessively to the point of basically fraud, I don't think that's a good thing to do. But that's unfortunately has happened in artificial intelligence, it's happened in quantum computers, and it certainly has happened in fusion reactors. And will probably continue because everyone's looking for clicks. And you can't write a kind of medium excitement article and get as many clicks as you can when you promote it as the next greatest thing to revolutionize the universe. Anyway, this is AC2GS. We're still here on the Limark Technical Net. We still have a little bit more time to chat. So if anyone is so inclined, hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
Well, I know I've promised to clear out a few times, but I have one more comment, and that is that I am old enough to remember when Popular Science and Popular Mechanics magazines both had flying cars on the cover, and we were all told to expect them in 20 years.
Yes, indeed. And I had a subscription. I didn't have a subscription to Popular Mechanics, but I did have a subscription to Popular Science and Popular Electronics. And I remember those articles about the future, and yes, indeed, they were flying cars and all kinds of things. And between you and me, basically, I think Elon Musk just kind of kept the old issues of Popular Science in his mother's basement and pulls them out every so often to hype his stock. Because he's hinting around that the Roadster might have a flying version available. Mind you, the Roadster has no available. He took about $250,000 from a whole bunch of people 8 years ago, saying it was just around the corner and hasn't shown anything yet. But he keeps on talking about flying cars. So, you know, don't give him any ideas. Thanks.
Okay, I'm serious. N1YDY, clear.
Okey-doke, but, you know, look, there's no penalty if you come back again. I have gone clear 4 times in a row at the end of this technical net, more than a dozen times. So you're always welcome, Hank. Okay, once again, AC2GS here. It's 9:57. If you want, we have about, 18 minutes of chatting about technology, amateur radio or non-amateur radio. A lot of technology in the world. We chatted a little bit about lasers. We didn't really talk about quantum computers. They're still around. They're still showing them. They still haven't proved them very useful for almost anything, but people see a lot of promise in it, and I wish them good luck. And, you know, it's a fascinating subject. It has to do with quantum entanglement. We've discussed quantum entanglement in the past and concepts of locality and non-locality when it comes to quantum mechanics and how to explain that things that are entangled with each other change instantaneously rather than at the speed of light, and all kinds of fun stuff. So we've gone down a whole bunch of different roads on our technical net. You never know what the next one will bring. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for now, please hit that push to talk.
So one of the postdocs in my lab came in talking about quantum entanglement, quantum computing recently, and his comment was that, I didn't like dig too deeply into the details, but his comment was that some people were testing a system where they had an entangled system, and they called up someone else and told them to, I don't know, to investigate it or probe it or whatever, and as soon as that external person started to do so, the entanglement collapsed. All right, and, you know, this is exactly the sort of thing we're talking about. Additionally, you know, I keep an eye on the universities, especially, you know, Stony Brook, which is management for Brookhaven National Lab, and they announced that they have funding for a node there, and there's several nodes in the Northeast for the quantum computing. And I just, in a practical sense, I just wanted to ask you if there was some sort of thing where you actually entangle things, and then, I don't know, what do? Drive them up to Connecticut and drop them off, and here's the other half of the entangled pair, or is there some other practice which these people are doing it, because it seems a little bit impenetrable to someone who's kind of a bench-level chemist QSO.
Yeah, well, one of the big pain-in-the-ass aspects about entanglement is keeping them entangled. And it's very difficult, and you don't kind of, there's no real good indication that they've been, that the entanglement has been disrupted, except that you have to kind of figure out that the two items are no longer in an entangled state. They no longer change at the same time. And the problem is, if you sneeze, you can provoke a disentanglement. That's the reason why quantum computers look like chandeliers, is because 95% of a quantum computer is a cryogenic pump to keep the temperatures at close to absolute zero. So that's a really big problem of how do you treat quantum entangled particles without accidentally disentangling them. And that's a lot of what the present research is, both getting the temperatures as close to zero as you possibly can, and also different ways of reinforcing detection of when entanglements fail. So, yeah, it's an enormous problem, and it's probably most of what the real research and development. Also, they're looking into into multiple qubits, quantum bits, in the same device. You know, so you can save a little money on the refrigeration and also do a lot more processing with more qubits. But those are the two major pain in the backsides as far as quantum computers are going.